This is Comic Shenanigans, episode 1034, Book of the Month Club, Spider-Man, Back from the Edge, and the Exile Returns.
On Comic Shenanigans. It went way back and covered off the original clone saga when the Jackal hatched his original scheme. Then, we flash forward to Peter under stress and near madness as he grips with his life. Now we ask, who am I? As one man is on the verge of leaving his humanity behind him and becoming the mask, another man wanders the chasm between his humanity and the memories that seem to define him. Unified by power and responsibility, both of these men are about to embark on a saga that impacted the 90s in a very profound way for the Spider books, for readers and creators alike. You take it or leave it, but these Spider bros are all pro blue hoodie all day. Comic Shenanigans is proud to present part 3 of our Clone Saga discussion.
Thank you, Paul. So I am your host, Adam Chapman. This is Comic Shenanigans 1034. It's our Book of the Month Club, Spider-Man, The Exile Returns, and Back from the Edge. Although we're also talking about power and responsibility, we're talking about the first 3 months of the Spider-Man Clone Saga. I'm joined by the dulcet tones, Paul Scores, who just gave us that beautiful intro, and also Nathan Struck, if you want to say hello as well.
Whose tones are decidedly less dulcet, but I'll make do.
So I want to do something a little bit different this time as we get into this, because we're really jumping into this 90s storyline. We're in August 1994 is when these books all went on sale. So I thought it'd be helpful to, just for a moment, look at what else was happening in the comic book landscape in terms of different publishing books. You had Aquaman just lost his hand to a bunch of piranhas in Aquaman 2 by Peter David that came out this same month. You have Zero Hour in full effect across the DC Universe. Most books are having zero issues. You have the Phalanx Covenant just starting in the X-Books over at Marvel. So that was just starting. You were only, I think, 3 or 4 months away from the Age of Apocalypse. As we speak in August 94, we have the third issue of the second Deadpool miniseries come out with Ian Churchill on art. We've got Thunderstrike is still halfway through its run on issue 13. We got a Ren and Stimpy show special, number 3, written by Dan Slott. Just some of the fun stuff that's happening in August 94. As we go into September, we have a Marvel Milestone Edition reprinting Amazing Spider-Man 149. I wonder why. We have the debut of the Marvel Action Hour comic book adaptations of the animated series FF and Iron Man. We got Mortal Kombat had a Goro Prince of Pain one-shot, miniseries.
Really?
Yeah. You had the Prowler had the first issue of a 4-issue miniseries come out. As we speak, in September, we have Uncanny X-Men 318. Jubilee leaves the team to join Generation X, which has its first issue that month. We got some great covers in the X office. We got Wolverine 87 with a Gambit and Wolverine cover by Adam Kubert. We got an X-Men 38 with an awesome Gambit.
Sorry, fantastic issue, though. I'm sorry for interrupting. Incredible issue.
It is. We got X-Men 38 with an amazing Gambit and Sabretooth cover. There was two that came out within like 6 months of each other. This is the second one with Gambit up with his bow staff against Sabretooth. Yep. So a lot of big stuff happening there. And in October, which is the third of the 3 months we're talking about today, we have the launch of Bishop's first miniseries. We got the launch of Hulk 2099. We got one of my favorite, although not very good, storylines of Iron Man, Hands of the Mandarin starts. One thing I wanted to mention is that Sabretooth apparently at this point was big enough to have his own Sabretooth Classic series, which he didn't even have a lot of appearances, but we're already on, I think, issue like 8 of the Classic issue. We had the first issue of Spider-Man Adventures, which is the adaptation of the animated series. We got Venom Separation Anxiety, which comes off right off the storyline that we're about to read today. We got Wolverine 88 with Deadpool on the cover, which is a very classic, very memorable cover. And then Uncanny X-Men 319 starts the Angel and Psylocke romance, which is the way I knew them for a long time, because that was the main romance I knew for the characters. X-Factor 109 begins Legion Quest. It begins here. And then in X-Men 39, it was a nice issue focused on Adam X. which is a very memorable cover, although a weirdly, it's a weird, weird cover to understand the physics or the body language that's happening there. The last things I'll mention before we actually talk about the issues, the top films of August 94 were Forrest Gump, Clear and Present Danger, The Mask, True Lies, and The Lion King.
All good movies.
Absolutely. And the top song for that month was Stay, I Missed You by Lisa Loeb. So, now that I've given you a lay of the land, pop culture, comic book land, that no one asked for, we can talk about the proper beginnings of the 90s Clone Saga, which really starts off in Power and Responsibility, which is this four-part epic that goes between all the main books of the time, Web of Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man, Spider-Man, and Spectacular Spider-Man. Nate, what were your first
beginning of the saga that will rock the Spider-Verse, as it said in the big splash on the cover?
That's right. So, Nate, what were your... you've obviously read this storyline before, but coming back to it now, given the context that we've just given it with reading the issues that kind of led up to this, did it change your feeling on this storyline? Did you enjoy the storyline? What was this for you?
I won't speak as much to the situation, its positionality in larger pop culture, I suppose, at least not right now. Maybe this isn't the sexiest way to talk about it, but I'm going to refer to the order in which, that at least Adam and I read through the more, at the time of this recording, the fairly recent Clone Saga Epic Collection release, Volume 27 of Amazing Spider-Man Epic Collection. And because my previous time reading this all the way through was in the Complete Collection Epic, where we see the lost years, right? Mm-hmm. The first story, and then we end up with some intro into the clone being kind of waking up in a vat, and then finally we get to the stories we see here. And I much preferred the actual chronological release. I should say this more correctly: the release order to the one that was in the Complete Epic Edition. So I enjoyed it more this time. I think it reads better. I think not having retcons and don't start with the retcon stuff. Don't start with the stuff that was used to explain it after the fact. I really preferred the original reading order. I felt that it just kind of flowed better. So that was my reaction this time reading it through. If that's much of a reaction, I know it seems very like analytical, but no soul to it. Do I like this? I don't know. I like parts of this. I don't know if I can overall say I like this.
You're not wrong that, I mean, it definitely the release order. So not the way that Paul unfortunately had to read it, because he's reading it in the Complete Clone Saga Epic. So he's having to jump around a little bit more to get exactly where we were. It's interesting. The Lost Years itself is the one story that really ruins that reading, like doing it this way, doing it the way it was originally presented, because it's such a weird, because like my son was like flipping through the Complete Clone Saga Epic Volume 1 today, and he was like, what? Because he was confused, because Ben's saying he's the true Spider-Man, which was true at the time. But if you don't have that context that this was published at the exact, you know, narrow period that he thought he was the real Spider-Man, then it really doesn't make a lot of sense. Like it's almost more confusing than not. And so kind of putting it at the beginning of reading this whole thing, you're right, it's adding a context clue that doesn't make sense. Whereas eventually, I'm hoping, and maybe it won't be in the eventual epics we get, because it's not called Amazing Spider-Man. It's not a crossover with Amazing Spider-Man. It is a separate thing that's a flashback, so I don't even know where they would necessarily put it. But if they put it in proper release order, at least then we'll be seeing Ben as Spider-Man and then getting this flashback, so it will make more sense.
I think we'll see it, right? I mean, it's a miniseries. It's really, I think, important to the flow of the overall storyline.
Is it? I mean, like, it's a flashback.
We see it all the time. I mean, in the X-Men epics, there's stuff that's not even really important. Like, magic is important for the new mutant storyline, obviously. But there's other stuff like, I don't know, the Nightcrawler miniseries or something like that, or Storm, that, like, you don't necessarily need most of the time. But I feel like it's directly related to the storyline going on at the time. I mean, I really hope they do. I can imagine them doing it. Anyway, yeah.
Paul, what was your impressions of Power and Responsibility? It starts the whole epic, like this whole big sprawling storyline. Is it worthy of that? Is it a good kickoff?
Are you talking based on reading it back now or based on at the time?
A little bit of both. I like if you can try and insert your mind. Like, did you read this at the time, or did you read this later?
No, I think I came back to it because I think my whole beginnings of the Clone Saga probably stem from like 118, right, when we hit Exile Returns.
Okay.
Because obviously, you know, seeing the Scarlet Spider costume on that cover, I think it was a friend of mine who introduced me to it at the time that this was going on. Because again, I wasn't. This was on the cusp of me getting back into comics, or getting into comics in general, sorry, at that point. And like, oh, this is a really cool looking thing. So then I remember as I started grabbing books from all different parts of it, kind of piecemeal, I was actually sifting through my collection just the other days where I found those four covers that I showcased to you guys on text there. I think I have this. I have these issues, apparently. I don't think I read them properly chronologically at the time. So now going back to reading it through in this trade format, and I have the complete collection. I vaguely remember some of the stuff, like, you know, the Jews Traveler and all these things. And then it was funny because I had just finished kind of reading the homework, and then you threw Life Theft at us kind of midway through my read of this. And then I had trouble kind of, cause, you know, Responsibility does touch on, you know, some of the stories from before, and Shrike's back in here, and the Chameleon's all weird, and like, oh, what happened to what story? At one point, it kind of cross pollinated, but at least there's some follow up in this from what we just kind of finished doing in Life Theft. So, you know, like looking at, you know, this Judas Traveler character, like I remember him vaguely from various storylines throughout the 90s, but it was like, I guess it's his first introduction at this point, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's interesting. So one of my favorite resources, and I'll always mention it, is the Life of Riley Archives, which was done in the early 2000s with Glenn Greenberg, who's at this point a friend of the show. At the time, you know, when I first read that, that was the first time I'd ever seen anyone talk about the behind the scenes of what the Clone Saga was. And he kind of says there that they had no idea who Judas Traveler was. No one knew. And he's like, that was basically something that was happening in the X office a lot at that time, is that they would introduce shadowy new characters, and then, you know, there'd be this sense of foreboding, and then nothing would happen. And that
this is full of that. This is going on constantly in here.
So they definitely did that with Judas Traveler. Now, not surprisingly, given how they write this character, J.M. DeMatteis loved him and thought this was a really fun, like, he loves the interpretation of good and evil. Like, that just sounds like a J.M. DeMatteis character. Now, the idea of using, like, Scryer as well was something that J.M. DeMatteis really wanted to use as well, and I believe used the original kind of godlike creature of Scryer in his Silver Surfer, I believe. So it definitely comes back because he loves that character. But yeah, they didn't really know what they were doing with this. So you just got the shadowy brand new characters. And I guess to show how cool they are, like, he can separate Carnage from Cletus Kasady at will. You know, you have to establish bona fides really quick, right? So it's very understandable why they do that. It's interesting reading it again. I thought of a few things. First of all, the whole, like, you have to come here and defeat me, if you defeat me, I won't kill all these villains, but then I'll let them loose. It did make me think of only 2 years earlier, you would have had in Batman a major storyline where Arkham Asylum was broken into, and all the villains were let loose, and then Batman had to slowly wear himself down and then eventually fight Bane. And so it definitely made me think of that. Like, that would have been in the ether, having all these villains potentially loose on New York would be a similar idea. So it definitely felt like that. Even the when Judas Traveler realizes that there is another, that felt very Star Wars to me. Like, you know, I thought this was the only one. Oh, there is another. Like, there's just a lot of cribbing from different places here, which was interesting. But I don't really know, what was the point of this? Like, it brings back Ben, but you really get that in the first issue. Like, the first issue of this storyline, you get them confronted with each other. You get the fact that Peter really doesn't know what to make of this, and he's so angry, and he thinks it's got to be someone out to get him again. Like, you get so much there, and then the next few issues are just kind of like, why? We almost don't need it. Like, it's almost
very filler. Yeah.
Yeah, like, this the core con, I guess, really, they wanted to figure out a way to have them come to blows in classic Marvel fashion and then become friends and allies to a degree, which is a very natural thing in comics, right? So I guess that's why they did this, is they wanted to create Ben Reilly as a viable character on his own, because the idea was to have him take over eventually as Spider-Man, hopefully in issue 400, which is obviously not what happened. It happened much later. But yeah, it feels like there's a lot of filler. It's not necessarily uninteresting, but there's a lot of angst. This is a very angsty period. Again, like you said, who am I? Like, that happens a lot. And it probably just goes on a little bit longer than it does, which is interesting, because once this first four issues is done, then I think the creative teams had a little bit more sense of what they wanted to do. They break the books up. You have two of the four titles follows Ben, two of the four follow Peter, and they just kind of do their own thing for 4 months. And that's really fun and engaging, but that first month is a little rough.
Yeah, I guess they're still trying to get their whole, like, situation sorted, right? I guess they came with a plan and they had it all written down on their napkins and whatever else, and trying to figure things out. Like, even looking, you know, in this issue, you see this entourage that Judas walks in. What's happening here? Who are, you know, one chick in drag, one dude in a trench coat with, like, a reporter. Their dude is, like, Johnny Blaze, or who was the other guy that was, like, in the 90s? Oh. Looks very similar to this guy.
Yeah.
What am I thinking here?
I can't think of it, but I know what you mean. You know what it feels like?
Are you thinking of Nomad, or what do you mean?
Oh, Nomad, yeah, that might be it.
Yeah.
It does feel like these characters were, like, if ChatGPT art, or, like, AI art was, like, 90s generic, you know, character. Like, a lot of, you know, certain archetypes are being used here, and not necessarily, like, you know, they stick around a little bit, but not much, and then they just kind of disappear.
Yeah. It's The Question and...
Yeah,
and then like Lila Cheney, and the kind of the punk pop almost aesthetic, and then Chakra, who is very professionally dressed, but they're all these like seemingly crude archetypes of the mind or of mental aspects.
Mm.
And again, Chakra is a more obvious one, but then you have like again, the detective gentleman, and you've got like the more kind of ironic punk kind of outsider who she has an ankh around her neck, which is kind of very much like Death from Sandman. Mm-hmm. And then you've got, I don't know, the loose cannon, the masculine Cobra, Sly Stallone as Cobra.
Right, yeah.
Mile Four. Like, so the violence, the balance, the chaotic, the logical, and then in the midst of them is this incredible caricature, I would say. I mean, incredible, my bad. I don't mean in the sense of like good. The art, the drawing here, the design. That's back. Did Bagley design the costume for Judas Traveler? Did he say that in the interview, or was it someone else who did?
I think it was someone else, but I might be Butler.
He's kind of like Brave Star cowboy mixed with, I don't know, some sort of like the Marines. I don't know what his pants are doing. It's kind of these striped. Maybe they're just like, or like an old Confederate Army outfits with a smock or a cape, and then the mustache, which reminds me of Bagley himself, that mustache, and then the long kind of, I don't know, is that mysterious hair, but very much like in this day and era, we're still, it's still very taboo to talk about mental health and needing psychology, psychologists, psychiatrists. And so this is the villainous depiction of the psychologist gone mad, right? The worry that some people have, you know, Homer says to Marge, like, no, you can't, we can't go to a therapist because he's going to turn everyone against me, right? I'm going to seem like the bad one. And they, or they're just going to take your money. Like all of these, I don't know, warnings about the witch doctory that the psychologist or psychiatrist will do to you, to your head. And not a very gentle touch here, right? He's the mad doctor who's here to play with his playthings and torture the tenants of, or the inmates of the institution, threatening to set them free. No one's redeemable. There's even a panel here. Buscema draws Sal Buscema, that I'm trying to show you two, of the inmates just absolutely, right? Everyone's insane and violent. Ben himself is, you know, worried about his own mental state, and Mary Jane is kind of also having a kind of a breakdown, existential breakdown, and Peter's having an existential crisis, an ontological crisis about who he is. Should he be monster? Should he be man? So there is a lot. You're right. It's a lot of heavy emotions, almost every page, a lot of angst, a lot of anger, and again, like very critical or negative, I would say, pejorative towards people who have mental illness. And then I think about, you know, Adam, you're talking about how this made me think about, or this is like referencing this or that. Then when you see No Way Home, and Peter says, I don't want to return these villains, quote unquote, to the timeline, for them to instantly die. We have to save them. And some people say, no, like, they're villains, let them go. And he's like, no, it's not their fault. Like, everyone here is suffering from severe mental illness to one degree or another, or loss or trauma. It isn't right. We can't just, you know, discard them. They're human beings. And so he wins the day in that argument, which I think is a very powerful and impassioned, very good Peter moment. Pair that much later text to this. The world's changed a lot in terms of, I guess, how people view mental illness. And it just highlights to me how Peter is out to lunch here. He's not, right? Not the compassionate, not the responsibility hero that you see Tom Holland be later. And so it just kind of, it's interesting now reading this again after thinking about that movie. And that's a really good Peter story. And I feel like this is an absentee Peter story. And I don't love it. And I know what they're doing. They're trying to set things up so Peter is removed slowly from the comic. He's less relatable. He's less the Peter we love, so we can fall in love with Ben. And I did fall in love with Ben, but I am not sympathetic to Peter in these issues. I just get more and more disturbed or upset by him, and I don't feel good when I read it.
Well, I think this is a big part of why Adam had us go back to Life Theft, to give us a little bit more context as to, like, Peter's headspace in coming into this, right? Because if you guys open this, we'll start here, right? We read this open, and it's like, yeah, why is Peter a big doucheface? Like, you know, so it's like, it gives a lot of extra context, so I can appreciate that, you know, Adam added that to the homework, so to speak. mm-hmm. But yeah, like, a very interesting time. Like, even the power set of these individuals, like, is this guy, you know, able to, you know, he's invulnerable, and he's causing this gooey cloud thing over the hospital, and he, like,
oh, Traveler, yeah.
Right? Like, how many different powers does this guy have? Are they mutants? Are they enhanced humans? Like, there's so much, you know, lacking of backstory. I don't want to drag on with Judas in this too much. I think we can all agree this is a very condensed story. You have, you know, kind of this battle within the asylum, and then I guess as Peter's trying to win the day against Judas, he's also, like, you can tell they're kind of starting him on the path home for, you know, I guess the redemption part, right? And that's, like, where, you know, I guess when we get eventually get back to the Edge, that's the whole point of Back to the Edge, is getting him away from just being the Spider, right? Like, he's trying to find his way back. It's kind of the early goings of him, you know, getting to the cusp of madness, and then, you know, at the end of this one issue, he's in a straitjacket and screaming at the top of his lungs because he's, you know, still descending into madness to a certain extent, but, you know, it's part of the turnaround, I think, starts here too.
It is a rough go for Peter. Yeah, if you're a fan of Peter, these are rough. These are not meant for you. Like, you know, as you said, like, this is to set up us up to love Ben and love this other guy. And, like, even the issues with Ben fighting Venom is specifically meant as to refute what Peter had been doing up to that point. Peter made a deal with this horrible villain. It was a couple of years earlier, so no one had any idea that they were going to use that later. But they definitely ended up being able to seize upon that. Obviously, they couldn't have Venom go back to jail because Venom was a viable property who needed to have an ongoing.
Yeah.
So Peter, unfortunately, had to make a choice that did not make sense for the character to let this guy go free. Which didn't, again, doesn't really make sense for the character, but it's what publishing wanted. But again, the writers were able to use that and say, oh no, this works for, like, us to show that maybe Peter's been out to lunch for a while. He's been corrupted by being Peter, being Spider-Man. Like, it's been a tough road, and you have this guy kind of coming off and being a little bit more fresh and being able to be more like the Spider-Man we remember. Although, with a lot of pathos, and a lot of angst.
Uh-huh. Oh, he has so much angst, yeah. I mean, it's the 90s. I mean, they're going up against Image Comics, the kings of angst, so you can see that almost like a competition, right? Who can out angst each other? And then you, of course, Nightfall and all the other stuff too, right? So
now
it's the era
when Power and Responsibility first came out. So there's two different versions of it. I only ever had the direct to market version. So the direct to market version is foil cover, and it's got a flip book, and that'll have another story that we can talk about. And the regular one just didn't have it, which is kind of crazy that's a pretty big chapter to explain what happened with the clone. And if you were just reading on newsstand, you never got that chapter because it wasn't a flip book. It was only if you were a direct market. And that is, you know, the kind of what is it called? Birth of a Spider-Man or whatever. And that's pretty, or it's called the double technically. And it's pretty important because it adds a lot of context. Now, given that you guys have now recently read the 70s clone saga, and then we got this, how did this inform your reading of this, knowing what the original was like?
I mean, I guess it helped me to see the references, the direct references, especially, of course, you know, because in the original comic, it picks up from where the clone enters, right? Peter wakes up and there's like another one.
Mm-hmm.
So that page is redrawn here, reimagined here by Liam Sharp. I don't know at any given time or any given page how I feel about Liam's art. The anatomy is kind of all over the place. Mm. I don't mind that because the book itself is twisted and all about twisting memories and deep feelings and emotions and thoughts. And so the over exaggerated features sometimes on characters kind of work for me. But there are other times when like people's heads disappear into their torsos or, you know, their entire lower back is just kind of misshapen. And so I don't know about the perspectives here, but the colors I really enjoy, particularly towards the end when we finally get to the incineration plant or the incinerating plant. There's a shot of the smokestacks and the orange, the deep kind of oranges and the blues there. There's something about coming back to that incineration plant over and over again throughout the mythos of Peter that, I don't know, I want to go there. Isn't that weird? I want to go to this gross, disgusting incineration plant. Like, it just seems so... It's become almost a magical place, if that's the right word.
Mm-hmm.
As a part of the mythology, like a castle in another situation. And then, of course, you get to this page that I think by reading the original, I appreciate more as well, of Peter getting ready to what fans assume is them sleeping together. And the clone, or sorry, I'm going to call him the real version, because in my headcanon, Ben is the real version. Outside, realizing that because one of them got to Mary Jane, or got to the embrace of Mary Jane first, that must mean, therefore, I'm the clone. What a conclusion to jump to. Comes out of a smokestack, I suppose, and then comes back to his own apartment and sees another man identical to him in the passionate embrace of Mary Jane, and then goes, I am the clone! Krakoom! To the thunder in the background. And I'm like, wow, that is not what I would do. I'd bust in the window and be like, get your hands off my friend, right? Like, and he just lives with that, right? And it's a very pathos-filled story, full of, again, more anguish. His life begins in pain and is filled with pain. So it's heartbreaking, but definitely is much better to read after having read the 70s source material. Like, I would be far less interested if I didn't know the original story.
One aspect, I don't know if they ever clearly ever talk about it, is in that story when the real one, as you say, or is when Ben wakes up outside the plant.
Yeah.
He wakes up outside the plant. He's like, I didn't know how it got here. And I don't know if
that's
they
right.
ever
yeah.
definitively said, like, how the jackal actually got him out of a smokestack.
Right. Or, I mean, you're left to think maybe the purpose of that was to say, is how many are there, right? Is there still one in the smokestack and this is the third one?
Well, that'll come into play later, obviously, because there is one in the smokestack, which also didn't really get explained either until a one-shot at the very end of the Clone Saga kind of hand-waved it away.
They just keep adding stuff because they're like, we can. I mean, Terry Kavanagh, I mean, props to him. I don't know if I love everything he's done, but I don't. But really, I love the idea of addressing the story again and going back into it. And as a soap opera, as a mechanic or a convention for soap operas, this is full of opportunities for them. How big was the lab? How many test tubes were there? How many vats were there? There's one in the smokestack. Okay. And this guy woke up outside. Like, they can just, and they do, right? They mine this clone of a clone of a clone. And so with a shock splash page at the end of like several issues of like, you know, Mary Jane aghast and agog, or Peter, no, not you. Like, they just keep doing that to us. Eventually, you know, of course it gets old, but it's interesting how often they do it.
So after Power and Responsibility, you got the Exile Returns, which I know for you guys is the big one. Cause that's where Ben truly becomes the Scarlet Spider. It's interesting looking at it now and reading it, you know, in this format, because when you get back from the edge, you get almost two separate stories. Like, it's not, whereas this one feels much more elongated because it's a very long Ben becoming Scarlet Spider, fighting Venom. it takes a long time, and I just feel like it's almost a little bit more repetitive. They didn't cover as much story ground, but it was more, I guess, more focused just on the venom of it all. So did it feel that way to you guys? Because it definitely felt to me like it was maybe padded on a little bit more, and it could have been more concise. Did it ever feel that way, or are you guys just so on board, you were like, nope, I love this?
I can agree with that. Obviously, you want to set the tone with Ben and have him go up against, you know, a big bad villain right off the hop. The fact that you have like an unlimited issue in here, and those tend to be an oversized issue as well. And the art on that is pretty rough, I must say.
It is.
So, like, there's one panel in particular where he's like uppercutting a guy and web it and shooting a web behind his back at the same time. It's really awkward looking.
Yeah,
I'm like, ooh, okay, that's a choice, right? And there's a lot of like, it's like every issue, it's like, you know, like my intro, like, who am I? Am I just memories? Am I just a man? Am I who is this? You know, and oh, I'm just a clone. And it seems to be, you know, every issue you're kind of trotting it. One thing I did like to discover though is a lot of these panels does mirror a whole bunch of trading cards that I have and didn't realize that this was, I guess, you know, where they pulled a lot of the art from. So it kind of gives me a different appreciation on some of that. So I did appreciate kind of looking back at this and go, oh, that's where that card came from. So that's kind of cool. But yeah, it was a lot of like, can we just get to you punching Venom in the face at some point? And yeah, it doesn't happen until kind of a bit later, and they have like 2 issues worth of going at it. But it's a pretty good bout. You get to see, you know, Ben use some of his cool new gadgets and whip out the impact webbing and, mm-hmm. and, you know, things are starting to set him apart. You know, very 90s, we got to give Spider-Man pouches. Okay, let's give him 2 cool ankle pouches for no reason whatsoever, right? Like, that's just, you know, seeing that kind of simple, you know, design of him, you know, just going all red, throwing on a hoodie and having his white eyes and the very 90s style kind of accessories to go along with him. And it gave him a very like kind of distinct and great look. I you know, kind of like to go back and understand, you know, all the different design choices and how many different kind of versions there might've been before they settled on this kind of final one, with the hoodie and everything. Would be intriguing to kind of dig into with the creator one day. But, you know, and then obviously we get the tease of, you know, Kane at the very end of the 2, right? So lurking in the shadows, another, you know, individual who's going to do it. That's 2 cents on it. Oh, see, I don't have that in my book, right?
Yeah, I'm showing Paul the end of the epic where it goes through a bunch of sketches.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them from Tom Lyle, but there's some from Mark Bagley in here too. So another reason to get you this copy with some text there and interviews. My understanding is, and you can help me fill this in, Adam, is that the goal was to make a costume that wasn't a costume.
Yeah, it needed to look like it was something thrown together. But why he would keep wearing it is a whole other thing, but that was the concept.
Do you think it achieved that, Adam? Does it feel like a costume that was just thrown together, a costume that isn't really a costume?
I mean, yeah, it is interesting looking at, like, when he first puts the hoodie on it, that he's just wearing a full red bodysuit. I'm like, that felt like almost a bridge too far in some ways. Like, if you were just throwing something together, would you have a head-to-toe red bodysuit? Maybe not. But, I mean, it's a fantastic design. I've always enjoyed it. I've always thought it would look great. I always loved the little flourishes, right? It's the web shooters that are on, you know, on top as opposed to kind of being embedded. You know, it's just a very cool, you got the belt. Again, everything about it is very of the time, but it works. It's interesting looking at the issues that, you know, as I said, they are a little slow, but they are also trying to cover a lot of ground because they're essentially building this book into being the Ben Reilly solo book. So you have Ken Ellis as his, you know, main foil, his Jameson, so to speak. Like, he's kind of up against this guy who names him and doesn't like the name and doesn't really like the guy. You have Betty Brant is kind of like, he's around and she's, you know, he's definitely like, oh, Betty Brant looks great. You know, a lot of like, weird stuff like that. But like, it's trying to build him up to have a little bit more of a life of his own. And like him even having like the classic, like someone falls off the bridge, but he saves them this time. And then, mm-hmm. if he wasn't here, that person would be dead, to try and, you know, kind of kickstart him realizing he has to stay in New York. Even it's always struck me as a little odd that the Exile Return starts with him just at you know, museum, as one does when they're trying to leave the city and forget everything about New York. I'm going to go to the museum for a day. You know, like, it just, it's one of those oddities, but they try to paper it off with some of the thought balloons, which actually made me realize this does not work in a modern context, because thought balloons aren't really a thing anymore. They don't really use them in comics.
I miss them.
And here, like, you kind of...
I miss them, too.
You kind of need them, because he doesn't have anyone to talk to say any of this stuff, and it would feel so forced if he was, like, talking to Ken Ellis, I'm such a fraud, who am I? Like, it wouldn't feel right. Like, it's already purple, but at least it's purple in his mind, and you can imagine that someone would think that and not necessarily say it.
You notice the small nod, too? Like, obviously it's not the logo, but he kind of has, like, a Yankees hat, but Peter's really a Mets fan, right? So even right then and there, you're kind of, like, setting him apart that he's, you know, different, right? You know, and actually, well, he's in the museum. Where's he going to buy his hoodie from? The museum at the gift shop, you know?
Right. It is, yeah. It's, and one thing I think we kind of mentioned it before, but we haven't really in this episode, is the month after Power and Responsibility is when the Spider-Man logo changes. So we go from the more classic logo to this more jagged 90s logo, which, again, I really enjoy. I started reading Spider-Man during this period. Of course, I would have an affinity for it. But it is this marked change that once this saga starts, that's when the logo changes. And for a lot of people, that is a negative connotation. They're like, oh, that's when the book becomes something I don't like. For me, it's like, oh, I'm all on board. I love this logo.
Yeah, it's like Ben is a different, like, spider. You know, like, you know, Peter's this kind of spider. Ben's that kind of, like, so to kind of denote themselves from each other. Even when he designs his own Spider-Man costume, he has the much bigger spider that goes across his body, comes back and beyond, kind of the same thing. It has, like, a cross, and they add kind of the angle to it in that design. So he always wants to be that extra little bit, you know, different. Like, he's the clone, but he's also his own person in a way. It's kind of, and that's the crux he keeps kind of balancing back and forth on. As a challenge to find his identity.
We got kind of lucky here, too, that when you look back on it, that when we were reading Pursuit, Web of Spider-Man was kind of the runt of the litter in terms of the art. The art just didn't... Tom Lyle was doing something exciting and very memorable in Spider-Man. You had Sal Buscema, very iconic looking Spider-Man in Spectacular. You had Mark Bagley just killing it on Amazing, and Webb kind of lagged behind, or it felt that way. And then, was that an unfortunate pun that I gave?
No, you dropped Mark. Mark has come up in different ways, and I just love your praise of Mr. Bagley. It's a friend of the show, Mark Bagley. I love to hear. It's, you're saying the truth. He is killing it in Amazing. He was doing a great job, and I'm enjoying listening. Adam is commenting on me smiling broadly. I'm just enjoying him talking about the Clone Saga. Keep going.
But what really I think works, especially when you look back on how Power and Responsibility starts, it starts in Web of Spider-Man. That's a bold move to me, because although it's not the highest selling Spider-Man book, it's the fourth. So by starting the storyline there, something big that everyone knows something big is happening, it does get more people to read a book that probably they weren't. So it probably works from that perspective. But it's going to live or die based on the art. And the art by Butler, because this is where he takes over. Like, this is his first issue as the regular penciler of Web of Spider-Man. And he kills it. Like, it looks fantastic. Yeah. Like, he's right up there with Bagley for me in this storyline in terms of how iconic looking his Peter looks, how good his Spider-Man looks. Like, it's just, he just hits the ground running. And again, he has a lot of stuff he has to do. He has to first, even if he didn't create the Judas Traveler and the host, you know, character designs, he's still the first one who's actually going to show you what they look like. So it has to, he has to grab you right off the top. And I think he really succeeds. And I think the storyline was much better for it. And I don't know, if he didn't have Butler, I don't know how well this would have started. Because that first issue, when you get that first page of the clone and Spider-Man just looking at each other, like, that's a really iconic moment. That's a fantastic-looking moment. And he sells it. And a lesser artist couldn't have done that.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I'm jumping back and forth in the collection and just looking at 118 and his work in Web of Spider-Man 118 is still really, really excellent. Reflections in mirrors and in cars and sheens and musculature and veins and venom. backgrounds are all detailed, buildings and perspective. Like, this is him after several months, and he's still doing great work. Like, he, going back and re-examining these, he's really standing out for me. Like, there are times when I'm liking his stuff more than Bagley's, which I never thought I would say or never thought I would think.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the Exile Returns is really just Web 118 and Spider-Man 52. Like, I know it continues on after that, like you're saying, but I think we really get everything we need here. We get his decision to stay, at least for the time being, to get a costume. Like you said, he saves it. He saves, quote unquote, a Gwen Stacy kind of damsel from falling off the bridge.
You also notice, like, in Spidey 52, in the cover, Stanley presents Spider-Man crossed out Ben Reilly.
Yes.
And that's the only issue of the four parts that does that.
Mm.
And that's interesting, because that's what the issue that I had. And I do want to talk about that exact thing you're mentioning in a quick second or in a moment. But so he's fighting and going to defeat Spider-Man's or Peter's biggest foe in Venom. He's going to pick up on Peter's lost love, Betty Brant. He's going to, right? He'll date her. He'll try to, you know, get her attention, get his own costume, get an apartment. And then 52, with that. So this is an issue I pick up. I think I'm at a drugstore or I'm at a grocery store waiting for mom to finish shopping. I go over to the spinner rack and I'm picking through books, and she comes over and said, before she pays, and she goes, "Do you want anything or something like that? Can I get you something, or can I get you a comic?" And I hold this out to her, and it was the cover, of course, by Tom Lyle that got my attention. I had never seen Spider-Man like this, but it's clearly Spider-Man because he's wearing red and blue. So they kept that coloration going. And I love what you said, Paul. I hadn't really thought about it that way, but yeah, the idea that Ben is a different kind of spider than Peter in more ways than one, but the way they've just kind of, the Tom Lyle designs that costume, again, this quick and dirty thrown together, a costume that's not a costume, something about the 90s, the grunge 90s, having him with a hoodie fits perfectly. But the sleek body stocking or costume underneath, it's the flowiness to it. Like, you, not a cape, but a kind of a cape, with the agile body-defining gymnast kind of style body suit. Something about that loose and tight just really works. It can still blow in the wind, right? The hoodie can blow in the wind, but you can still see the definition of his muscles with the suit. And then the rain pouring. I love a good rain over Ben's head. And I don't know what I'm looking at because I'm not really following month to month, and that cross out of Spider-Man and writing in Ben Reilly, someone has replaced Peter Parker, clearly, or someone's replaced Spider-Man. This is a replacement character, and I just was so hooked, and I was drawing panel after panel from this in my sketch pad, in particular, the one where Ben is, which page is this? Let me get this page. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It's a half-page shot of Ben swinging with his arms crossed like this to pull the strands of the webbing, and his legs splayed out in an almost McFarlane-esque impossible splay. And the colors, it's primary colors. It's red and it's yellow and it's blue. And it's almost gauche, but in the rain crossing over him in the opposite direction of his webbing. I don't know. There's just so much emotion here. And then kicking Venom in the gut to thunder and lightning over. That's the exact panel. Yeah, I drew that. It's an opera, guys. Like, this is, and he fights the impossible villain. He gets cut. We don't like fakes. And he's holding his guts in and webbing himself together and going, "I guess I die here. I guess I deserve to die. I'm nothing. I'm a fake." And he survives. It's just such high octane. And there's a female symbiote who's come in, and I'm like, "Who's this?" I know it continues after this, but it doesn't get any better than this. I feel like at 52 and 118. Are what you need to really introduce Ben, and I love it. I really love it. I think it's great. And the pacing is ruined a little bit by the continuation of the story, but the art's still good.
I will say, I think that Lyle is probably second only to, like, JRJR in terms of really good rain shots. Like, there's just something about him doing characters in the rain, and we see a lot of that when Lyle is doing the book. There's a lot of, like, later on, I think during the Mark of Cain, there's just a lot of, you know, wet, You know, and he does probably the best version of, you know, Ben Reilly or a Spider-Man, I guess, really, in just plain clothes with just the mask on and like the gloves. Like, because we see that later in Mark of Cain where he's wearing like the black costume mask. But there's just something really dynamic about it. And he probably does it the best. And he does it a bunch of times. Yeah. But there's just something really exciting about how he brings it to life.
Yeah, I gotta get me a Tom Lyle original page one of these days. I don't care if it's a rock. I gotta get something from him. I do love him.
He did really good art. I mean, it's really sad, obviously, that he passed away, because I would love to talk to him about this stuff. Like, he did such amazing work, and I'm just so curious about what it was like to come on and hit this hard, you know? And obviously, he'd already been on the book, what, a year and a half by this point? Like, he was drawing Spider-Man during Maximum Carnage, which was Spider-Man 35, this is what, 16, 17 issues later. So, like, you know, he has a pretty good run, and yet he's still firing on all cylinders and really, you know, making it exciting.
And they give him a chance to reinvent essentially a Spider-Man for the new era, the replacement Peter, the one who won't have the same quote-unquote problems of having a marriage. Mm-hmm. They can make him single again, and like, okay, you get to do the costume, and you get to, you know, create some of these initial storylines. And I would love to see what he felt about that in conjunction with or connection with his experiences growing up reading original, perhaps, Spidey comics. Like, what did this feel like? Sadly he passed.
Yeah. We should mention,
I have to guess that some of the, no, sorry to jump in, but the repetition of it all might be hankering to, like, who knows when someone picked up their first issue of this, right? And they're just trying to that whole, like, everybody's first comic book type of situation. So if, you know, if you're reading along in this collected format now, you're like, okay, Ben, yes, you're the clone, you're a better person than you think you are, but okay, I deserve to die. I'm trying to live in my own hoodie I just designed. Oh my god, I'm such a loser. Like, you know, it's okay, bud. But hearing it over and over and over is like, you know, I'm hopefully he gets past it, you know, fairly quick as we move on in the storylines. I can't always remember as well as I used to, but you know, that was probably a mandate at the beginning to really help part of the establishment piece to make sure that everyone realizes kind of what's going on and where he finds himself at the beginning.
For sure. So let's talk about Back from the Edge, because we've ignored it a little bit. Now, it is very different from The Exile Returns, because again, instead of really being a true four-part storyline, it's really two-part storylines, part of an overall four-parter. But I mean, it's very much more of a thematic storyline more than anything, with Spider-Man trying to find his way back from the edge that he found himself in Power and Responsibility. And, you know, this starts his kind of journey back. I would say Web of Death really works more on that, obviously, and furthering the concepts here. The first two issues, we have Puma, we have Nocturne. For those who don't know who Nocturne is, no one does. She was one of those characters, I think in 92 or 93, every annual that year introduced a new character. And all but one or two are basically forgotten now. One of them, that's a crazy shot. One of them,
she's not the good one from Exiles, just to clarify.
Well, exactly, yeah. There's a much more prominent Nocturne from Marvel now. This one was Angela Karen. One of the other characters that was released that summer in the annuals who did end up making it big was Jenna Spell. So that was, you know, unfortunately, this Nocturne did not quite hit the same way. It's Tom DeFalco and Jam DeMatteis are writing this particular storyline. Again, it's full of angst. Peter's got a lot of angst and a lot of emotions. You have this Nocturne character trying to kind of figure things out about it. What I do like about this more than anything is in part two, kind of setting up what's going to happen in the following two issues, you do have a brief moment where you see Daredevil kind of swing by, and he's like, oh, Daredevil, that's the new Daredevil. Like, just kind of bringing everyone back up to speed before the next issue. What did you guys think of the first two issues of Back from the Edge? I have a lot to say about second parts three and four, but I've left this less to say about one and two.
Paul, go ahead, Ernie. Let me go first.
Well, go for it.
No, you go ahead.
Well, now we're just stuck in a loop. So I will say, of any of these issues, my favorite part is the Mary Jane stuff. Mm. I find that the only really compelling thing here. I love to see the black costume, armor, Daredevil stuff. And I think you had mentioned this in the Mark Bagley interview, or one of the interviews, Adam, that you feel correct me if I get this wrong, that of all the people to draw the costume besides McDaniel, that you think Bagley does it is one of the best, if not the best. Mm-hmm. And I disagree with that. I mean, he's, you know, Buscema does an admirable job, but I really, really enjoy Mark's black costume for Daredevil. So that those visuals were nice, but at the time, maybe as a youth, I mean, I had, what did I have? I had 395. And so I enjoyed the Mark Bagley art. Again, more rain. But I wasn't as interested in the Mary Jane storyline. Now, as I guess an adult, I am only interested in it. I think the fact that she gets an arc is great. I think she's been put through the ringer, feeling abandoned by Peter, and she is. But she shows an inner strength and goes to try to reconcile with her family and figure things out. And like, kind of, like, I left things on a bad note, and we don't connect enough. And I really want a relationship with you, and I want a relationship with my nephew, and. You know, there's just a page that Sal does really well in. Shoot this as I flip. This is spectacular 218 that I'll try to show you two. Right, it's just kind of a six panel horizontal of a conversation over coffee, and I loved it. I kept trying to skip past the Puma stuff, the constant beating of the Puma and Peter to get to this, and so I felt it ended well. With her kind of coming into a character arc and having some realizations and some changes. So that's this for me.
It's interesting. That particular issue of Spectacular was written by Tom DeFalco, and he was the one who really started layering in this backstory for Mary Jane to begin with, back in the, 250s or so, with Ron Frenz. So it makes sense that he would have a more deft hand at really exploring what's going on with her and her and Gale and being able to explore that more, because he's, again, the one who kind of brought that backstory up to begin with. So it felt very natural to see him kind of going into it more. When you have DeMatteis writing those components, it feels a little bit more heavy-handed, feels a little less natural, and feels much more kind of to make a point, because he's just a different type of writer than Tom was. But it's interesting to kind of see how that exploration of Mary Jane kind of continues. Again, in the Spectacular, well, I guess, 219, again, because it's a Tom issue, it does feel like you get more meaningful exploration of MJ there.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it's very melodramatic. All the stuff, most of the stuff with DeMatteis, she's, crying or seeing ghosts, and the DeFalco stuff is a bit more real.
So I never had this or read any of this. Like, it's not part of my collection. So, like, for me reading it now was a kind of for the first time. And, like, knowing what I know now, it's like, in the chronology of it all, it's almost in a weird spot. I feel like you almost could have done this instead of the whole Judas Traveler piece, because this feels more of a direct sequel to some of the stuff they were working on in Life Theft, you know, the Wilkshire back and the Owsley stuff, and the Puma part's weird, but a lot of stuff in here I feel could have been an easy kind of segue to really truly begin, you know, Peter's going back. I mean, but they may want to pad it out a bit more, I guess, from a story perspective, but, you know, considering how much real time has lapsed at this point, they hit these issues between when Life Theft was published, it's kind of an interesting kind of circling back to that to kind of maybe finish it up.
It's interesting reading, again, the Back from the Edge parts 3 and 4, because in a lot of ways, Chichester never wrote a Daredevil, like once Matt Murdock had the armor on, it was a very angsty-filled book. It was turned up to 11. McDaniel's art was insane, not always coherently insane, but generally insane and over the top. And so here we get these quieter moments with Matt that we never got in the main book, and much more almost introspective than, again, we ever got in the main Daredevil book at the time. Even, like, I think this is my favorite version of the Owl. I would say it's actually not really representative of who that character usually is and has been for most of his history, but this will always be the version I love because it was the first one I read. So I read, you know, Amazing Spider-Man 395 was a gift. I guess it was probably my 11th birthday. And one of the things I got was Amazing Spider-Man 396. I loved it. I loved Daredevil in here. I thought Daredevil was awesome. I didn't realize he had a black, you know, a former costume. I didn't realize this was anything different because, again, I had barely read any comics, but I was starting to read comics and I really loved this. I remember liking it so much that I went to the newsstand to get the next chapter because I wanted to find out what was going to happen in Spectacular Spider-Man. So I have that original kind of newsstand version somewhere. So that this was extremely impactful to me as a young fan. Again, so many of these pages, like, they're burned into my memory. Like, those first few comics, like you said, Nate, with that Spider-Man issue, that you know every panel because you drew it all the time and you read it so much. Like, when you had only a couple issues, you read those issues over and over and over again.
Yep.
And that's how I felt about Amazing Spider-Man 396. Like, everything about it, to being able to talk to Mark Bagley and be like, this book meant a lot to me. Like, I know you've done every issue under the sun and you've done a million comics, but this one will always mean something really special to me. And so being able to read it again is always a pleasure because it's just so good. It's very over the top. It's very melodramatic. Like, all the stuff, even about Matt being like, you have to kill Peter Parker now, and all this stuff is very over the top. But when I was a kid, I was like, yeah, like, that's intense. Like, that's, you know, that's, I probably would not have said that's so metal, but it has that kind of that connotation of the time. And I love how by the end of that particular issue, Matt Murdock realized, like, maybe he made a mistake. Like, he shouldn't have told him this. He shouldn't have told him to kill Peter. Like, that was not the right call. It's a fascinating exploration of Matt as a character because we get a little bit into his mind, but not really. And so he's kind of being an asshole, right? Like, he's not, Peter's in pain and a tremendous amount of pain. And he can't just say, you're right, I'm Matt. You know, he can't just let his guard down and be like, no, you're right, I'm Matt, and we can talk through this. He's still kind of got to have that veneer up for some reason, and he's giving some terrible advice, but it's kind of what Peter needs to hear too, because it's kind of what Peter wants him to say. He's like, I'm trying to kill Peter, I can't kill him, you killed Matt, how do you do this? And even Matt saying, like, well, if I was Matt, which I'm not, this is what I would do. Like, it's really interesting. The art is, again, brilliant by Bagley. The Owsley and Vulture stuff is really interesting because it's much less of a Vulture story than it is an Owsley story, who's, again, not a Spider-Man character typically. He sometimes shows up, but he's typically not really a character we see a lot in Spider-Man. So I just really liked it. It did feel interesting to me that this was the first time we saw Vulture after Life Theft. And when I first read this, obviously I had no context for that. After Life Theft, he's catatonic, right? Like, he's not really, we only see him in one image, but it makes it look like he's not really there. And now here, he's pretty much back to normal. Like, he's got his senses. So I feel like we kind of missed something off panel, that they didn't really explain how he is back to kind of normal. When you do get into Spectacular Spider-Man 219, love that cover. Very dynamic. The colors are really interesting in terms of the lighting. You get that first page. I don't know how I kept reading this book because it is one of the worst, like, first pages I can imagine, with Daredevil's face in this horrible scrunch with this, like, demonic goblin nose. Yeah, like, I don't know what happened. Like, this is not Sal Buscema. Like, he's a good artist, and something happened.
Yeah, thank God that was just for effect and not the actual art in that book, because they'd be like, woof, we took a step back after that Bagley issue the month
before. Right? Like, it was awful.
The splash is supposed to make you want to turn the page. That makes me want to turn the page just to get away from it.
Yeah, or that makes me want to just put the cover back, you know? Like, I don't want to keep going. But again, the issue's fun. You know, it's got a good climax. I always, as a kid, loved that last page, right? Because you have both, you have a close-up on Spider-Man's face, and you're slowly getting farther away. And then on the opposite side of the page, you have MJ, you know, far away, and then slowly panning in. So I like that opposite. And you have MJ excited about the future, and Spider-Man realizing that the antidote he just took was a fake. I thought this was a great way to end an issue. Like, this made me want to read what happens next. Because MJ's about to say something, she's excited, and everything that she's about to say makes sense now as to why she wanted to reconnect and fix things with her family. Spider-Man realizes, you know, yes, I may not want to kill myself anymore, may not want to kill Peter anymore, but I'm going to die, which is a very classic Peter moment, right? Like, he finally gets his mind right, but his body's about to fail him. That seems very classic. So anyways, I love these two issues more than I should. They may not be the best, but I love them anyway.
Well, I mean, I hope you don't think we gave this short shrift. We're trying to avoid this one. It's just kind of, it's the last story in the collection.
You guys are Ben heads. You guys are hardcore Ben heads, as am I, but I get it. Like, that's, you know, the Scarlet Spider's first appearance is going to be the most exciting thing in this book for you guys. For me, it can't be, only because I have nostalgia. It fuels my love of Back from the Edge. And only chapters 3 and 4. I hadn't read chapters 1 and 2 for years. It took me forever to read those. And I was like, this is nowhere near as good as the last two chapters.
Yeah, even for me, who had chapter 1 as a kid, it was not my favorite Spider-Man comic. It was like fine. There's a great art in it, but 395 fans, like, whatever. The cover is probably one of the best parts of it, so I think that I agree with you in that regard. But this is definitely something you've been waiting to talk about, wanting to talk about for a long time. So, like, yeah, for sure. Express your love.
Well, I mean, I will say, the next time we chat, we're going to be talking about, I'm not sure exactly where I'm going to cut it off, but we're going to be talking about Web of Life, Web of Death next, which I really enjoy. I think, again, Web of Life, I think, is actually the more inferior storyline. I think Web of Death is better. And then I think after that, it's Smoke and Mirrors. And then I guess we're pretty much into issue 400. So we're getting close to the death of Aunt May. Let me ask a question of you guys. Do you feel any foreshadowing that Aunt May is actually about to die? Or do you think that feels kind of afield?
I mean, certainly they have, been showing, telegraphing this for a while, but you never know with comics, right? This could just be drama meant to bring Ben back. If it was just a story point to bring Ben back into the equation, then they've done their job and they don't need to kill her. But, I mean, I really appreciate the younger versions of Aunt May, who feels more relatable and more kind of in a motherly rather than a grandmotherly position for Peter. Nothing against grandmas. So the younger Marissa Tomei Aunt May, really like that. They kind of de-age her and make her more hip in Ultimate Spider-Man as well. It was just a choice, right, with Ditko and Lee to make her as old as she was with her wheat cakes and always worrying about Peter, but that never really spoke to me. So having her pass on in her elderly age and just kind of say to Peter, I always knew you were Spider-Man, that very meaningful, I mean, I'm jumping ahead, I know, but a meaningful moment for me, and I was very happy with 400 the way that it was. So I didn't think at the time that surely she'll die, but I think they handled it well, and I really think that's one of the characters that I don't think bringing her back, and you guys have read more Spider-Man in recent years than I have, I don't think bringing her back has been better than letting her rest. I feel like letting her rest in 400, for me anyway, was the better way to go. So yeah, I guess I've kind of always wanted her to die.
I think you're correct for the most part. I think, like, taking her off the table, I know writers like her, but I think she wasn't maybe needing to add as much meaningful. Like, when they killed her off, I think there was also a symmetry that you had Peter and MJ about to be parents, so he loses his parent. So I think that was a nice touch. I do think that the best thing that they ever did with her since, it took years, like I think 2 or 3 years before they finally realized what to do with her, and that's when JMS at least had her know the secret. For real this time, and actually be part of this inner circle of Peter and having an understanding of what he's doing as Spider-Man, I thought was really interesting. And, something that just, secret identities, they're much less prevalent these days, but they were, they used to be the thing, and everything was about keeping your secret identity. And then once Aunt May found out, it made her more interesting because she was in on it. Before that, and now she had storylines that were more interesting to her. Like, she would be worried about him, but actually be worried about him, not just in a weird, like, oh, I'm my frail Peter. Like, now she's like, no, you're going to fight supervillains. You might die. Like, there's just something very different about that. Her being mad at the Bugle and wanting to, like, cancel her subscription because of all their bad press of her nephew. Like, that feels more interesting because now she's in on the secret. There's only, I guess they went, 400, 500 issues without her knowing. And then once she knew, it made her feel more viable and more vital. And then once they kind of took that all back after One More Day, it kind of regressed the character. Now, yes, she's been married since. They've had sequences of, like, her having sex with J. Jonah Jameson Sr. and, like, Peter walking in on them. And it's super uncomfortable as a reader to be like, I don't want to think about Aunt May getting busy with J. Jonah Jameson's dad. Like, that's not cool. But at least in theory, it gave the character something or someone to do, but it was not necessary.
Yeah, I mean, again, it feels like, I guess we've jumped ahead in some way, but I mean, there'll be a lot to say, a lot to talk about with 400 when we get there anyway.
I'll have to figure it out, how far we want to go, because 400 is like the ending and a beginning, which apparently was part of the design. They didn't want to make it a great jumping off point. They wanted to make it a point where you come for Aunt May's death. That sounds terrible. But you can't leave because afterwards Peter's in jail. Like, what do you do next? Right. And that's a very, that's what you do in episodic storytelling. You have to come up with some sort of way to, serial storytelling, I should say, to really grab people's attention and say, you have to come back. because you have to figure out how to get out of this.
Yeah, and it goes into a lot of high drama too, with like Ben trying to be there and not able to be in the room in that issue too. And again, I'm jumping ahead, but you know, Mary Jane intersecting or crossing paths with him, and she doesn't want to see him, she doesn't want to meet him. So it's a lot of fun high octane drama that's coming up for the series that I think would draw in a lot of new readers. And yeah, something about just ending with 400, that one kind of storyline with Aunt May, who's been there since the beginning, and now Ben is going to take center stage. And he can't really have an Aunt May, because the idea was she can't know Peter's secret. And then if she knew Ben, she would know Peter's secret. So you kind of have to move her off stage, and then give him a new supporting cast. So it just all seemed like it was coming together. And I liked all of it. And it's weird. There's still a part of me that it felt like this. These storylines that go forward damaged Peter to me so much that, and Ben just grows large, you know, lives large for me that I'm still to this day just kind of waiting for Ben to get his own book again in a good way and not in a weird Peter David, you know, series way.
I know. Paul, I think I cut you off when asking you about how you felt about the Daredevil issues, because as you said, you didn't really care for the Puma issues, but what did you think of Daredevil's inclusion here?
I agree with you. It was... Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Paul.
That's right.
Either one of you.
No, it was really cool to see, like, Daredevil, like, in that, again, I don't read any Daredevil of any kind outside of Zdarsky's run. It's only, like, Daredevil run I've actually ever read, right? Mm-hmm. So to see kind of, so if I was a new reader at the time, just getting into the Spider books, and then I see this Daredevil character drawn immaculately by Bagley, because you're right, and that issue is right on point. The costume is just amazingly depicted, and, the curiosity I would have after reading that of, you know, Daredevil have killing Matt and having this interaction with Peter of wanting to kind of mirror what he's done, is it would be very intriguing. Like, oh, like what's going on with this cool looking character? I want to read his book too. So it's kind of a great way to kind of cross promote the characters, I think, if you want to look at it from that perspective. And then of course, knowing way more now in comic knowledge than I did back then, you know, kind of cool to see, you know, you always like that, you know, the co-star, you know, aspect of things, you know, like even if you look back to the Exile Returns, when you have, you know, Venom, and then you have the Scream symbiote in there, so you're trying to get, where's the history behind that? So you gotta go to the Venom books to try to find out what she's all about. So, you know, it's very, and, you know, this is before a time you, like, I know they still have, you know, read this issue or go see this issue, but I don't think there's a lot of that, the footnoting really given here, was there? Or did I miss it?
No, I don't think there was much, actually, now that you mention it.
Yeah. So, that's, I guess, it's maybe a slight miss for when it was published at the time, but, yeah, I do always enjoy kind of ways to expand the universe and have everything kind of be connected in a way that this world building, because it's a big part of, you know, the kind of media we live in today. So I always appreciate that in material.
And I was going to say, I don't really have much to add, Adam. I felt this. I felt similar. That Matt seems way too harsh, and he's not even like going to play the game. Like, this is another superhero talking. Like, I love a good conversation between superheroes on a rooftop, and they're constantly on rooftops. And like, Matt won't talk to him about stuff. Like, he's just not playing, and I didn't enjoy that. And I know, yeah, I totally agree with you, the Chichester stuff and the Fall from Grace stuff, and it's all very heavy and broody, but this is just it's almost like there's little value in him being here. It's almost like a number of the lessons Peter could have learned on his own by just kind of brooding in the rain, right, and talking to a gargoyle. So nice to see him, nice to see the costume, but I don't necessarily see him as valuable in the storyline. I'm always a little frustrated. It's almost like every time I read it, I'm like, this time he'll say he's Matt. This time he'll actually help his best friend, Peter. It's got to be, right? I'm misremembering this. And he just kind of disappoints me the whole time. And I'm like, dude, there's so few people that understand you. Like, this is a guy that's, yeah, like you said, he's like, I'm splitting in half here. I'm coming undone. And for him to kind of, to know what that feels like and to not have the empathy to go, yeah, you know what? We're brothers in this. We're two of a kind. I feel it's a missed opportunity to move Matt forward too, and so I don't love that.
No, they're two very different places, it seems, at this point in their thing. It's like he's trying to, like, stick to character, for lack of a better term, and really dive into it and not, you know, if he tells Peter what's going on, then who knows how else it gets out to the community at large or whatever it is. And like, you can tell it in the thought bubbles, like, you know, Matt's struggling with the decision to, does he help him? Like, here Peter is just like, he's mask off in the microscope, he's doing, he doesn't care right now, he's just trying to figure all this crap out. He just thinks his, you know, responsibilities out the window, and you know, I guess Matt's trying to find a different way to rein him in, and I guess his decision on tough love, you know, it kind of wins out in the end, and who knows if Peter actually ever believes, you know, this Matt not being Matt ever happened. So, I don't know, it didn't not work for me, as I guess as it doesn't work for you, Nate. I think it was, you know, it made sense as I read it.
I will say, Nate, if you in your collection, page 386 is this is a page where I think Cool Lines artwork headed up for sale a few years ago. I think it was like 1300, 1500. Like, I just couldn't swing it, but God, I wanted that page because, again, it's an issue that means a lot to me. You got Daredevil at the pier or at the dock, and then Spider-Man's like kind of just there behind him, and Matt's just like, now what do you want? And so that page, if I had been willing to spend so much money, like, that was like US too, like, it would have been like over $2,000. I just could not swing that, but that would have been that is just such a beautiful page.
You heard him, listeners. Find that page and get it to him.
It's pretty expensive. Anyways, well, okay, guys, thank you so much for chatting about the, you know, the proper Clone Saga that we love now. I've made you guys go through the 70s. I made you go through Life Theft. And now we'll finally get to the stuff that you guys like the most, which is the beginning. Like, the beginning part of the Clone Saga is the most coherent. You know, it's the most put together because it hasn't started losing its way. I will argue that once Ben is Spider-Man, the first couple months are kind of free of, you know, some of that feeling.
That's solid.
Yeah, because they feel like they can, you know, just move forward. They had to deal with getting here, and now they get to enjoy it. And then within 2 or 3 months, they realize, no, we got to bring Peter back. And then everything starts to change again.
I feel like even through this, you know, three storylines, you're just kind of scratching the surface. Like, you have, you know, kind of a mixed story. You kind of have, you know, Ben, you know, building his costume and fighting Venom. And then you have, you know, basically 4 issues, like, at least for that one storyline, is all focused on Peter coming back from the fallout of the previous story arc. So I feel like we've only just kind of begun, right? And I'm thinking, maybe back then, at the time, I think I was just hunting for anything with Ben on the cover, right? That's what I was looking to buy. So if you look at those issues where there was no Ben O'Reilly, it explains why I maybe didn't have those in part of my collection. I remember reading them because I wasn't looking for Peter stuff, I was looking for Ben stuff. So it's very interesting how, you know, don't judge a book by its cover, but that's exactly what I was doing, looking for, you know, where's my Scarlet Spider costume, because I want to read the books that he's staring at, because that's what had kind of captured me for, you know.
I love that you could have the 2 books for Ben and the 2 books for Peter. I love that you could get it all, or you could pick your Spider. That's really cool. Let's do that again. Bring that back.
Bring that back?
Yeah. That 2 books a month for Ben, 2 books for Peter.
I mean, that seems fair. All right. Well, next time at the end of April, we'll talk about the next few months worth of the Clone Saga, which, it's really great stuff. I think you guys will probably enjoy Love Web of Life more because, again, it's the Ben heavy stuff. I love the Web of Death because it's a lot of Doc Ock stuff, which I think is really enjoyable and engaging.
That's a good story.
We get to see Stunner, who, you know, is a character.
What did Bagley say about that? What was he drawing from for Stunner?
I think it was She-Hulk, right?
You're right, She-Hulk, yeah.
When you look at her now, you're like, oh yeah, that's basically the archetype of She-Hulk. Like, she's not that
Blonde
dissimilar.
She-Hulk, yeah.
Yeah. Even her personality at being very, like, kind of excited to be running around. Like, she just seems very happy and energetic. Yeah.
A little brash. Yeah.
Very, you know, of a certain period, Jen Walters. Like, not necessarily modern Jen Walters, but there was a period of Jen Walters who would have been a lot like that.
Yeah. Interesting.
Well, again, thank you so much, guys, for joining me for this. For those listening, you can always email me at comicshenanigans@gmail.com. Rate the show on Apple Podcasts, listen to us on Apple Podcasts, and also listen to us on Spotify. Upcoming episodes include another conversation with J.M. DeMatteis, hopefully talking about Chameleon, as we mentioned in a previous episode. Would love to pick his brain about that. We have a colorist from Virtual Calligraphy coming on in a few weeks as well. We have the inker Joe Rubenstein coming on the show. We've got, as I mentioned, upcoming Book of the Month at the end of April. And then we also have an episode with Mark Russell that we're working on right now. So a lot of good stuff in the next month or so. And then also we'll be having Pat Olaf back to talk about the Marvel Superheroes Secret Wars Battle World miniseries. That is too many words. Anyways, thank you so much for joining us, and we will catch you next time. Bye-bye.